Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Charlie from Walk the Walk Home Group, YMSing PA.
My name is Charlie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Charlie.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. You know, I've been thinking about all day about what I want to say, and you know what. What's going to be funny, and what things you can relate to, and I kind of hope that I can just set all that aside and speak from my heart, because when I hear people share from their heart, I think it means the most to me as a recovering person. They call it the language of the heart. So that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. And I want to thank Lauren for the opportunity to come over and speak to you tonight. She came to my home group recruiting speakers. And so that's how I got invited here. And it's really cool to be in Quakertown tonight. So anyway, you know, I don't know how to... I've been going to AA meetings for 29 years. And I really don't know how to cram 29 years of experience into an hour, but I'll try. I first got sober in, I'll start at the beginning. You know, I was born in Doylestown, Bucks County. I lived on a farm out back when there were farms outside of Doylestown. I don't know if many of you remember that. Grew up in a family where my dad was an alcoholic engineer and my mom was a crazy artist. And it made for some pretty tumultuous times. So I'm also an ACOA and probably a whole lot of other things besides just an alcoholic. But, you know... My drinking started when I was 16. I was still riding a bicycle, so I guess I was probably 15. My buddy and I, my mom had moved my family up to Long Island, New York. And I didn't want to move there, and I was scared shitless. But we moved there, and you know, I had this buddy, Paul. And he was my best friend, and he said, hey, have you ever had a 7 and 7? And I said, what the hell's a 7 and 7? So his dad was a dentist and had a boat in dry dock, and he took me down to the boat, and we climbed aboard, and he started making 7 and 7s. And to me, they tasted like ginger, you know, like 7-Up. Yeah. And so we got back on our bikes, and I thought, what's the big deal, you know? I didn't really feel anything. And we got back on our bikes and started riding back to his house. And as I was riding my bike, all of a sudden, it hit me. This wave of euphoria came over me. And I felt like the kid in the movie E.T. where his bicycle takes off. That is exactly what I felt like. All of a sudden, you know, I was a fat, pimply kid in my teenage years. And all of a sudden, I was skinny and handsome and, you know, I could do anything. And that was my first drink. And, you know... I remember we used to, in New York, you could drink at 18. I was 16, and I was a big kid, so we would go to this deli and put our $1.65 on the counter, and the guy would give us a paper bag, and we'd go to the back cooler, get our six-pack of Budweiser, put it in a paper bag, and walk out the back door. And we did that every Friday and Saturday night that we possibly could. Unless there was like 4 feet of snow. That was about the only time. But every other Friday and Saturday night, winter, summer, spring, we were out there. And not my drinking really, I love to drink. I love that feeling that I got when I drank. It fixed every problem that I had. And, you know, it's kind of funny because it did for me what I couldn't do for myself, which I found out somebody else could do that later on. So what makes me an alcoholic? You know, today I describe myself as an alcoholic. And you know, when I read the book, I know that I'm a real alcoholic. I'm not a moderate drinker. I'm not a heavy drinker. I'm a real alcoholic. When I drink, I have no idea where it's going to go. I always want more. And, you know, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about, you know, the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. When I put a drink in my body, I want another one and another one and another one. And, you know, those few times where I can stop drinking for some period of time, I have an obsession of the mind, and that curious, the peculiar mental blank spot and the obsession drive me back to drinking. So I'm either drinking or I'm thinking about drinking. And that's the state of me in my disease. You know, did I get drunk every night? Did I drink a handle every night? No. I was a big beer drinker. I loved to drink shots of whiskey along with beer. That was my favorite combination. And I actually learned how to make beer because I had watched Gilligan's Island a little too much as a kid. And I had this fantasy that I was going to end up on a desert island somewhere. And I wanted to make sure no matter where I ended up, I would be able to make something that had alcohol in it. And so I learned how to make beer, and I promised my first wife at the time, I told her that if I make beer, if she'll let me get all the stuff, you know, to be able to make beer, I'll stop buying beer. So I got all the stuff, and I was buying beer. And she said, "Hey, what's up with this? You said you weren't going to buy beer. If you made beer, you weren't going to buy beer." And I just told her, you know, demand has outstripped production. You know, and we were both industrial engineers, so that was funny to us. But yeah, I just couldn't keep up. I would make a couple cases and they'd be gone. And I was going to make it to give it. Part of the sales pitch was I would make it and then I would drink some and then I would give away some. Well, I think I gave away out of the hundreds or thousands of bottles of beer I made, I probably gave away about 3 bottles. So that didn't work out so well. And my dream was to start a microbrewery. And I never did that. And, you know, after I got sober, they started coming out with all the microbreweries. And I had a big resentment about that. And I'll talk about that in a little while. But you know, alcohol became more important and more important in my life. I went to Penn State. Part of the reason I wanted to go to Penn State was it was a party school. And I wanted to party. But fear got me through college. I had this fear of failure that I didn't want to have to go back to my family in disgrace, having failed out of school. So whenever I had to, I studied. And the rest of the time, I liked to drink. And I did other things. This is an AA meeting, and I want to respect that. But I did other things, too. And I was always looking for that magical combination that would put me in a place like nirvana, you know? I was constantly searching for that. So you know, after I graduated, I moved to Cleveland, Ohio, I got a job out of school. And, you know, I didn't know anybody in Cleveland. And so the best idea I could come up with is drink, you know. And my drinking was pretty heavy up, you know, at that point. But one night, I took a night off, and I decided I'm not going to drink tonight. Because I think it was starting to scare me. As I had mentioned before, my dad was an alcoholic, and he was a horrible drunk. I mean, he was an angry drunk. He was abusive. And he was a real nice guy when he was sober. But when he was drunk, he was just a terror. And so I didn't want to become an alcoholic because I was a happy drunk. You know, when I got drunk, I got happy because I had that warm, fuzzy feeling inside that I didn't give a shit what happened. So I just wanted to be drunk. And so anyway, I saw how my drinking was going, and I thought, I'm going to take a night off. And I was about 23 at the time. And I just took the night off. And I woke up the next day and I felt like a million bucks. No hangover, just felt alive. And I thought, I got to do this more often. And I don't think I ever did it again until I was 32. So anyway, you know how we do, I know how I did, I don't know how you guys did it, but when I would be in a new place, I would start to make friendships and relationships, and I had working relationships, and after a while, I started screwing those up, you know, through my drinking. I'd screw this person over, or screw that person over, or not show up, or, you know, it was just always something. So after about a year and a half, I had shit in my nest enough that it was time to move. And I decided to really move. So I ended up getting a job where they promised to send me to California. And I moved out there and started to work. And again, there was this pattern of, you know, I would go to a new place you know, things would start to get messy, you know, and my drinking was always a part of that, and the other things that I did was always a part of that. And, you know, I changed jobs, and I always, when I first got sober, I thought, well, I never got fired from a job. Well, if I had stayed there a little longer, I probably would have got fired at most of my jobs. But I could read the writing on the wall and got out before I got fired. So I changed jobs and I did a number of things and ended up in the aerospace industry. And I ended up getting married, and I was about 30, I guess I was 31 when I got married. And the real reason I got married was I thought, well, I'm 31, I should be married. You know, and I got married. And that's not a great reason to get married. But anyway. So my drinking progressed more and more and more. And, you know, my world got smaller. And, you know, I remember the last night that I drank, when I first got sober, was somebody had posted a happy hour sign on the bulletin board at work at about, I don't know, 1 o'clock, right after lunch. And I sat there salivating for the rest of the afternoon about going to happy hour. And at 4 o'clock, I was out the door. We ended up going to a place called Bobby McGee's. And I remember, I was either the first one or the second one there. And I started ordering double vodka martinis. And I had, every time the waitress would come by, I would get another one and another one. And I had them lined up because I did not want to run out. And needless to say, I got shit-faced that night. Pardon my French. Sorry about that. I was totally wasted. And I ended up with one of the secretaries from work that night. And, you know, I went home and I saw my wife. My wife met me at the door at like 4 o'clock in the morning, begging me to tell her where I had been. And, you know, I ended up telling her, and I remember she was crying, and she kept asking me, why? Why? And out of my mouth came, because I'm an alcoholic, I can't control my drinking. And I swear I did not say those words, but that's what came out of my mouth. And, you know, I had seen my dad get sober. He got sober in 68, and this was 1989 when I first came to AA. And so he had been sober for over 20 years, and I called him up that morning, and I said, Dad, you know, I can't control my drinking. It's really affecting my work. It's affecting my marriage. It's affecting every part of my life. And I don't know what to do. And actually, I really wasn't so focused on my drinking. I was focused on all the problems that I was having. And he said, son, go to a meeting. And I was like, a meeting? What's a meeting gonna do? Like, I need like rehab or something. And he just kept saying, son, go to a meeting. And I ended up going to a meeting from another fellowship that night. And I just, I couldn't relate. I was living in Oakland, Oakland, California at the time. And I just couldn't relate. And, you know, there was this old AA guy in the back of the meeting. And he shared towards the end of the meeting, he said, like, my name's Bob and I'm an alcoholic. And when he spoke, it just sounded like music. I don't even know what he said, but I related to every single thing that he said. And I thought, you know, I think I'm going to try to go to an AA meeting. And the next day I did go to an AA meeting at the Fremont Fellowship in Fremont, California, which was used to be in an old pool hall behind a Chinese restaurant. And when I pulled up to the, this was the days before GPS. You know, with GPS, you know where you are, right? Back in the day, you didn't know where you were. And I pulled into this place, and I was like, wow, this looks kind of weird. But I did see the AA sign and the symbol. And I thought, well, I guess this is where the meeting is. And these two guys came out. They had been outside smoking a cigarette, and they walked over to me and they said, are you looking for an AA meeting? And I said, yeah, I am. And so they invited me in. And this place was pretty rough looking. But when I walked into that fellowship, I saw the 12 steps and the 12 traditions up on the wall, and I had no idea what they were. And I had this intuitive feeling that I just might find what I was looking for. When I was drinking, I was always searching for something. That, you know, I was searching for the magic combination that would fix everything that felt wrong inside of me. I was searching for, you know, the perfect person that was going to make me happy, the perfect job. I was always searching for what was going to fix me. And when I walked into that fellowship, I thought, I had this intuitive feeling like you just might find what you're looking for. And I don't know, you know, today I think that came from my higher power, letting me know I was in the right place, because by all the looks of this place, I was not in the right place. So they asked me to read How It Works, and I was, at the time, I was a manager of engineering for a mid-size aerospace company, working on top-secret projects. They hand me how it works, and I could barely read it. That's how far gone I was. And how I still had that job, I'll never know. But I could barely read how it works. And it just boggles my mind. But I sat through that meeting, and there was, you know, there was this really old guy there. He was probably 70. I thought he was like 90. And, you know, I remember kind of barfing up all my problems, and, you know, because there were only about five people at that meeting, and just kind of throwing up all over them. And the guy said, "Son, this disease is like an elevator, and it's going one way, it's going down, and it's going to go all the way to the basement if that's how far you ride it." He said, "But you can get off at any floor you want, but you got to take the steps back up." And I'll never forget that, because it was just what I needed to hear when I needed to hear it. And, you know, I had no idea what getting sober meant. All I knew is I was really nervous. I sat on my hands a lot. I didn't like to get I love coffee, but I didn't want to drink coffee during the meetings because I was like shaking like this. I went to a meeting. They suggested 90 and 90. And I thought, okay, well, I really don't want to do that. But I ended up probably going to 270 meetings in the first 90 days. I was going to meetings all the time. And that's kind of how I got sober. But I found a fellowship near where I worked. It was a clubhouse. It was called the Tri-Valley Fellowship. And they had meetings morning, noon, and night. And I went there and started going to meetings there, started getting to know people. They were very welcoming. They had a coffee bar, and they encouraged me to do service at the coffee bar, and I got to know a lot of people that way. And that started my journey in sobriety. I ended up relapsing after about a year and a half. I went on a business trip down to L.A., and I thought, well, I don't want to go to meetings in L.A. because they make you do this. They make you get up in front of everybody when you share. And I was like, I'm not going to get up at a microphone and share in a meeting. And so I thought, I'll take my books, you know, and I was working on the steps at the time with a sponsor. I'll just take my step stuff and my books, and I'll just stay sober for the 2 weeks I'm going to be in L.A. Well, that lasted about 5 or 6 days. And I ended up, I had two beers the first day. And the next day, I was in the hotel bar, absolutely falling down drunk. And I could not stop. I crawled back to my room. I got up the next day. I had to go to work. It was just amazing to me how I had no control whatsoever. It was just like everything they had said. And so I ended up going to a meeting after that. And I went to a meeting every day while I was in L.A. And I didn't like their meetings. They were different from where the meetings in Northern California. So, but I went anyway because I wanted to get sober. And so I was coming up on almost a 2 year anniversary, I guess. And it would have been, I forget what anniversary it was, but my dad was coming out to give me my coin. And I ended up that was in November of 90 that I drank. And I ended up having to tell him that I had drank. But he came out anyway. And he was like, "Hey, are you sober?" And I said, yeah. And he said, that's all that matters. The time is not important. So, and when I got back to Northern California, I didn't want to tell anybody that I had drank because I was afraid of what they would think. I was afraid they'd think I was like some kind of dumb shit. Or, you know, I was afraid. And so, when I finally had to get honest, and they said, we're so glad you made it through that and that you're back. And it was completely the opposite of what I thought they were going to say. And it was nothing but love and reaching out to me. And so I ended up, I got a new sponsor and really started to get in, you know, everybody I talked to said, the best thing you can do is start the steps over again. So I did. And, you know, went through them with a new sponsor. And I don't know how I'm going to compress this. But anyway, you know, I just, for some of the newer people in the room, I just wanted enough AA to get me by so that I didn't drink. You know, when I went through the steps, I never really got into 10, 11, and 12. I kind of stopped with the amends. I made my amends, and then I felt really good about that. And I was like, well, I'm going to look at 10 and look at 11 and look at 12. But, you know, I really never lived in steps 10, 11, and 12. And, you know, I stayed sober for 15 years. I stayed sober through moving across the country. I stayed sober through a absolutely horrendous divorce, a custody battle. Stayed sober through financial wreckage. And, you know, things were just starting to go well again in my life. And I had a sponsor at the time. He always would say, meeting makers make it. I hate that saying today. And I'm not going to say that's what got me drunk, but that mentality is, that's great in the beginning, you know. If you're in your first 6 months of sobriety, go to lots of meetings because you're going to have a much better chance of staying sober than not going to meetings. But if you've got 5 years or 7 years or 10 years and you're still saying meeting makers make it and that's how you stay sober, you need to open the book. And I don't mean to be harsh, but my reality is I also had, I ended up getting another sponsor who said, 4 through 9, 4 through 9. It's all about 4 through 9. If you've got a problem, just work steps 4 through 9 around it. You know, take the inventory, talk about it. You know, look at your defects, make amends. And those are some great tools. But as a sober alcoholic, where I need to live is in 10, 11, and 12. I need to practice all the steps. I can never forget the first step, you know? And on a regular basis, like a daily basis, I need to turn my will and my life over to the care of my Creator. I need to ask to have my defects removed. But where I really need to live is in 10, 11, and 12. I need to take a continuous inventory of my actions. I need to grow in finding out who my Creator is, trying to understand more about it. Or I'm never going to understand God. And if I can understand God, my God is really way too small. But I need to try to grow in spiritual principles and move in that direction. And I need to take the evening inventory. I need to plan my day in that, you know, using the tools in the paragraph of On Awakening. you know, I need to try to practice these principles in all my affairs. And the most important thing is, I need to help another alcoholic. Because if I'm not giving this thing away, I am not going to keep it. And if I, you know, I'll tell you a little funny story. I was about 14 years sober. I had everything I thought I wanted. And I would go to meetings, and I was so tired of hearing the newcomers. Wham, 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 wham. And I wanted to start a meeting where you had to have 5 years of sobriety to come to. That was my great idea. Needless to say, I got drunk. The day I can't relate to a newcomer is the day I just might become one. So think about that. So I was 15 years, I just celebrated my 15-year anniversary, having gone through lots of stuff that life throws at you. I stayed sober through it all. And when I had everything that I thought I wanted, a guy came up to me and said, "Hey, you want a joint?" And he gave me a joint for a Christmas present. And I thought I would be one of those old AA guys. That's an outside issue, right? We're an AA, not MA, right? That's my best thinking. So I took it, you know, instead of, now if he had offered me a double vodka martini, I would have said, "Whoa. No, I don't drink." But that's not what he offered me. So I took it, and I thought, well, I could be one of those old AA guys that smokes pot once in a while. Now, I don't know anybody like that. I think they're kind of like a unicorn, you know? They don't really exist. They're like a high probability that they could exist, but they don't really exist. They're a fantasy. I think that's what that is. So I thought, well, this probably isn't very smart, but I thought, I'll put it in a test tube. That's it. I'll put it in a test tube, I'll put a cork in that test tube, and I'll write on the test tube, "For emergency use only." Right? Never called my sponsor, never said, "Hey, Joe, guy just gave me a joint, what do you think? Should I smoke it?" Never did that. I took it home, never made it into a test tube. I just lit it up and smoked it. And then I went back and I bought an ounce. And Wow. And I smoked pot alcoholically. And I was, again, an engineering manager for a major medical company making instruments for eye surgery, which was a pretty technical thing. And I got stoned almost every day for about 4 months. And then I had to go on a business trip. And I was smart enough to realize, like, hey, you shouldn't take marijuana on a business trip. So my wife dropped me off at the airport. I walked right into the bar. As soon as she was out of vision, I went right into the bar. And remember that resentment about microbreweries? I ordered the biggest Samuel Adams I could possibly get my hands on, because that had come out after I got sober. And I was pissed because I never got to try that. So I had to have two, right? And there were these big schooner things. Never saw a beer that big. And I thought, you know, when I had the first one, I thought, when I put this to my lips, and I was sitting there going, you haven't had a drink in 15 and a half years. When you put that to your lips, a giant airliner is going to come crashing through this terminal and kill you and everybody around you. And I just had this vision of dying in this fiery death. And I thought, I put it to my lips and I drank it and nothing happened. Well, I mean, I got drunk, but nothing happened. And if you haven't drank for 15 years, a beer this big is going to do some damage. So then I had to have another one because I have the disease of more. You know, when I have one, I got to have more. And there really isn't enough for how much I want. There never was enough of what we thought we wanted. So that business trip was a horrible adventure. You know, I went right into the, you know, they sell in Texas, which is where I was, Houston. They sell beer and stuff in grocery stores. So I just went to the grocery store and started picking out all these beers that I never had a chance to try. And did that for a week. And then and I came back and I went to an AA meeting. And I'd like to say that's, you know, I just got sober again and everything was okay. And that's not how it worked out. That started a relapse that went on and off for 5 years. And I ended up in a mental hospital because I had a nervous breakdown. When the gravity of what I had done hit me, I ended up this writhing ball of tears and snot on the floor. You know, and my wife took me to the hospital and I spent a week in a mental health unit. But I couldn't stop, you know. I would drive past the liquor store and, maybe I'll get a couple mini bottles, you know. Those won't hurt as bad. And that's what I would do, you know, and I would get sober for a few weeks, and then I would get drunk. And I was going to meetings all along, because that's all I knew. I had done that for, like, the better part of 17 years. That AA was all I knew how to do. So, but I couldn't get sober. So my wife had an interior decorating business, and I ended up going down to the Atlantic City Boat Show. I was going to buy this 45-foot boat because that's where I was going to go drink. I was going to have it moored down in Baltimore, and I was going to go drink on my boat, right? And it had to be a big boat. So thank God I didn't do that. But I did go to the boat show. And I got drunk at the boat show. And I came back. And my wife called. I wanted to go home, take a shower, brush my teeth, you know, get all cleaned up so my wife wouldn't know that I had been drinking. And she called me on my, unfortunately, cell phones had come along. She called me and asked me to come to where her job site was. So I went there. And I got out of the car, and as soon as I started walking up this drive to this house she was working on, she said, "You've been drinking, haven't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And I had hidden this from her for over a year. When she would go to bed, I would go down in the basement and drink and do other things. And I had successfully hidden it. And I think part of it was she didn't want to know. But this was so blatant, she couldn't not face it. So gave me an ultimatum. She said, "You get sober or I'm leaving." And this was my third wife at the time. So I had been through the ringer a couple times. And I didn't want to go through that ringer again. So she actually, you know, she and another friend of mine saved my life because I did not want to stop drinking. Once I got into it, I did not want to stop. But I said, I'll go because you want me to go. And I went down to Father Martin's, and Father Martin's Ashley down in Havre de Grace. And once I got there, I realized the gravity of what had happened and started to realize, like, you know what, I really do want to be sober. And I'd like to say, well, that's the end of the story, but it's not. You know, I came home, I started working the steps again with a sponsor, going to meetings, basically doing the same thing I had done in my previous period of sobriety. And I was about 2.5 years sober, and this guy offered me a joint at work. And you'd think, through everything I had been through, I would be like, oh no, that and the double martini, I don't do those, you know? But I didn't. And I took it home, and I smoked it, and I thought I was going to go insane. I thought my brain was going to blow up. And I don't know if there was any extra stuff in there or not, but I thought I was going to go insane. But what I realized was, I want to be sober. And so the next day, I went to an AA meeting, and that was on 10-10-10. And today, that's my sobriety date. And, you know, today, my home group is a big book study meeting, because that, and I remember I was going to my home group, and somebody came, one of the other home group members came in, and this was like very shortly after, you know, my anniversary date. And he said, let's make this a big book study. And I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be in a big book study home group. All they do is talk about the book. So I fought it. And we started off, we're a two-night meeting. We meet Tuesdays and Thursdays. And what I said is, like, my opinion was, like, let's make one of the nights a big book study. So that's how we started. And then later on, people really liked it, and we ended up making the other night a step study. Now, they're two different formats, but... and today, I love my home group, and I have learned so much. I wish I would have found a big book study from the very start, because for me, that's... the answers are in the book. And just when I think I have evolved past any of those answers, I'm confronted with something that the answer is in the book. I have since retired from work. I spend a lot of my time involved in AA. I have 10 sponsees right now, but I do that because I can. And, you know, however many sponsees you have, you know, try to fit them into your life. That, I believe, is some of the most important work that we can possibly do, is pass on what we've been given. I'm also the DCM for District 66 over in Berks County. So I spend a lot of my time going to area functions. And it's a wonderful opportunity to see the whole service structure of AA and really get involved and see how the whole process works of an informed group conscience, and how the delegate takes that to the General Service Conference, and really how AA works. But, you know, the most important part of AA is none of that. The most important part is this, the group. The group is the most important part of AA, and home group members are very important. Now, the newcomer is the most important person, but in terms of AA structure, the group is the most important. So I'm very involved with my home group. You know, I just... I don't know. I just love the book. Every part of it. I actually got some T-shirts printed up that said, "We heard no more of Fred for a while." Those of you who know the book know the story of Fred and how self-knowledge will not keep me sober. And that's a really important lesson, because I can know this shit up in my head, but unless I'm actually walking this path, unless I'm actually giving this thing away or trying to, you know, preserve, work in the service of AA so that it's here for the next generation, you know, I'm really shorting myself. Until I actually have a sponsee and take a sponsee through the steps, I really haven't experienced the depth of what's in step 12. You know, I really haven't had a spiritual awakening until I've started to give this thing away. And that's so important for me today. Because as an alcoholic, we have the unique ability to help another alcoholic. Because an alcoholic can only get sober if he hears a message that has depth and weight. He has to see, because we're like doubting Thomases. You know, if somebody who's not an alcoholic says, "Oh, well, if you do this, this, and this, you'll get sober." I'm like, do you know what it's like to be an alcoholic? But if somebody who is an alcoholic, a recovered alcoholic, tells me what they did, there's some probability that it might work out that way. When I first got to AA and I heard about God, man, I wanted to run the other way. But I had no choice but to stay in my seat, because I had tried to stop over and over and over, only to be driven back to it. I would wake up, stuff coming out of both ends of me, and I'd be like, "I'm never going to drink again." And by noon, I was cracking them open, because that's about how long I could stay sober. So, you know, we're all miracles. To suffer from this disease and to be in this room in a sober state of mind is a miracle. So I congratulate you guys for being here tonight. And, you know, it's, we are doomed, but we're also blessed. You know, I love that sentence in the book where it talks about to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to face a spiritual solution are not always easy alternatives to face. You know, that's where we are. I have a deadly disease, but I also have a solution. And I don't have to die from this disease. I can have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I can live each day, one day at a time, and hopefully get to the end sober. My dad, like I mentioned, my dad got sober in 68, and he died in 2008, and he had 40 years of sobriety. He was one of the ones that made it all the way through, which is amazing, because I love to hear people who have long-term sobriety. And I learned a lot. You know, there are days when I you know, take out the hammer and I start beating myself, you know, because I would have had 29 years if I hadn't picked up a drink. But that's not my experience. And I believe that is so I can come here and share with you what I did and what I did wrong, what I believe I did wrong from my experience, so that maybe you guys don't have to do that. And again, the most important thing I can do is try to live in 10, 11, and 12 and give this away at every opportunity. Because there's so many people out there that need it. Unfortunately, it's a program for people who want it. I have a sponsee right now. He needs this program, but he's not sure if he wants it. And that's kind of hard to watch. But, you know, I'm there for him when he does want it. I can't make him want it. I also have a daughter who's 21, and she's struggling desperately with this disease. And so I go to our sister fellowship, Al-Anon, to deal with those issues as they come up. And that's so frustrating because I spend a lot of my week helping young guys get sober, and I can't really help my daughter that much, other than to just be there as a father and to love her from afar. It's just, that's really hard. It's a deadly disease, and it's easy to forget that it's a deadly disease. But thank God we have a solution today. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. So I think that's all I have.